Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, December the 10th. We will talk this hour with a Harvard business professor who says America can be a can-do nation once again by following six opportunities. We will talk about those opportunities and we will welcome your questions and your suggestions as well at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. And to get you started thinking about what these opportunities are, our guest says that we should widen the net of prosperity by creating opportunities for people of all social and economic classes to participate in the science-based white coat economy. We should be supporting real family values through fair and flexible workplaces. We should instill a values-based capitalism on businesses that are well-run, make lots of money, and do lots of good. We will talk about these three opportunities and more, and welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. And we are happy to have her with us. Rosabeth Moss Cantor is the Arbuckle Professor of Business at Harvard Business School. Her current work involves not only global corporations, but transformations of major institutions such as healthcare delivery and educational systems. She is the author of America the Principled: Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Go
ahead.
I was just going to ask you about the weather.
Hey, we have had more snow than we need, as far as I'm concerned, but we have some ice and sleet and freezing rain and light snow in the forecast again for tonight and tomorrow.
It'll be heading to us soon.
Yeah, it's been quite a December. What makes you say we're not a can-do nation now, Professor Cantor?
Well, the last 7 years have taken a big toll on the country. It's the recession in the early part of this century. The whole new century has been a down mood. There was first a recession because the dot-com bubble burst, then the terrorist attacks, then an unpopular war, much more partisanship than we had seen in recent years, neighbors attacking neighbors. So a recent poll showed that the whole national mood is down, that close to 70% of the American people think the country is heading in the wrong direction. And they might not agree on what the new direction should be, but people are pretty upset. And so in many of those things, we've lost sight of what the country stands for. And I think if we get back in touch with what the country stands for, we already have demonstrations of things that can get us back on track in a positive, progressive way.
Yeah. And by progressive, are you talking political ideology when you say progressive?
I'm talking about a view of progress. I mean, that progress is possible, that we're not stuck where we are today, that it's not all doom and gloom. The world is not about to end, that there are competitive challenges, China, India, et cetera, but those can be overcome. That's the real meaning of progressive. It's actually a very Wisconsin type of word.
Oh, yeah, we know that word here. Bob LaFalle and all. You do have these six opportunities. Some of them deal with business and the economy, but others do deal with our government. And since you talked about the poll saying that most of us think we're headed in the wrong direction and maybe we don't know what we want. You think, though, that we need to stop denigrating government and reinvent government. Why do you think that's important?
I definitely do. I mean, I think that for some of the great natural disasters of recent years, like Hurricane Katrina, which really upset the nation, not to mention the Delta region, are a failure not just of immediate response by local, state, and national government, but they're the result of over 25 years of ideology in which politicians would run for public office by saying, I'm against government and I'm going to tear it down. And where is the respect for public service as an honorable calling. Congressional ethics scandals have Congress toward the bottom of the list of institutions in which people have confidence. This is really terrible because we count on government. Now, again, we don't all agree about how much government, and our founders said that government is best that governs least. But you can't govern least that is leanly unless you govern best, because if you govern worst, it costs you more money. I mean, bridges falling down in Minnesota, that really got to me because Minnesota, Wisconsin's great neighbor, I always thought was a place that would invest in infrastructure. So we should have a dialogue about how much government, but we should stop saying government is the enemy. In some cases, the private sector does a worse job when government services are turned over to it. And young people are turning away from the idea of public service, and that really hurts the country.
Yeah, and do you think that we should be implementing some sort of national service programs?
We definitely should have national service. In fact, there's a national and community service, because mm-hmm. national service is really delivered at the community level. AmeriCorps, which was the outgrowth of things, by the way, the first President Bush stood for, it was then implemented by President Clinton. It's an incredibly popular program, but it's so small, 75,000 or so AmeriCorps members, compared to the number of young people that would sign up to give a year of civilian service to their country. Teach for America is now the most popular recruiter on many college campuses. And so we need to provide that opportunity, the infrastructure for people to serve. And not only would that get people involved in the public sphere, but that's one of the best things for healing our partisan divides. When people are painting a school together or tutoring children together, they sort of put aside Republican, Democrat, charter schools, public schools, because they care about helping real people. I think philanthropy and service are the things that can unite us again. And that image of the generous American could help our image abroad.
Yeah, that's this national service could do something about the ugly American syndrome?
Well, sure, because many service programs are, in fact, geared toward working not only in the U.S., but also in other countries. I'm on the national board of an organization called City Year. That's two words, City Year. People can Google it, which was the model for AmeriCorps. And it's now in 17 U.S. cities with a very active youth corps that leads many other people into serving schools, mostly kids. And in fact, it's leading middle school kids and elementary school kids and adults into service. But it also has opened an affiliate in South Africa, is looking at the UK. It's like the Peace Corps, an urban Peace Corps, but an idea we can take elsewhere in the world. And what really matters in our image in the world, you're probably very aware of this, there's a big gap between how people view America, the country, versus Americans, the people. There are much more favorable views of Americans, the people, because we're seen as open, creative, generous. It's the country at the moment, meaning the government, the current administration, that people in other countries are unhappy about.
Yeah, let's talk some about this opportunity that you also advocate in getting everyone involved in the white coat economy.
Yes, this is. I had a little fun with calling this the white coat economy because we all know about the transition from blue collar to white collar. In fact, we all know about the problems of the blue collar auto industry economy. White collar meaning services and professionals and so forth. But I began to see that the things that are going to make us prosperous in the future and that are already the main driver of job creation in certain regions, including Massachusetts, where I'm from, is things involving science and discovery. It's not just innovation, entrepreneurship. That's always been a classic strength, and we should keep it. But in addition, it's the new discovery coming from science, coming from the life sciences, from the helping professionals. It's applying innovation to solving problems. It's using science and scientific reasoning. It's getting even kids involved in, for example, a search for biofuels. One of my favorite stories is the high school in New Hampshire where a chemistry class is trying to develop a biofuel to run the school buses. That's pretty ambitious for kids. And they are collecting used cooking oil from local restaurants, thereby helping the restaurants with waste. And they're experimenting with how to turn that into a biofuel. And they're using the byproducts to make soap and selling it to fund their project. Now, isn't that incredible? Kids saying, we can do something. We can use science to help the environment. We should be enlisting all of us, and of course we've got to teach these subjects in a much better way because this is our source of strength in our economy, is that we have these breakthrough inventions and then we know how to commercialize them and sell them to the world and use them for our own benefit.
Our guest is Rosabeth Most Kanter, professor of business at Harvard Business School and author of the book America the Principled, Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. She says that terrorism and economic recession and war have dampened the national mood, but a progressive agenda can bring back the American dream. And she says Americans are hungry for that progressive agenda. We're talking about that agenda and these six opportunities she sees for becoming a can-do nation once again. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for her on all of this at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. After 5, you can join Ben and his guest for a frank and open discussion about racism in America. That's after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with Rosabeth Most Kanter, author of America the Principled, Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890 if you have a question or a comment for our guest. And before we go to the phones, though, Professor Kanter, let's talk about a couple of these opportunities that we haven't touched on yet. And that one of them is that we should support real family values through fair and flexible workplaces. You don't think we do that enough?
Nope. Mm. And thank you for that question, because the word family values has been hijacked from the right to mean that hijacked by the right to mean that government can snoop in the bedroom and tell us what we can and can't do, that they're going to teach character, which often means not teaching science. But I think what family values would really mean if they infused our public policy is making it possible for people to have families and earn a living. And we have some problems. I mean, there are increasingly flexible workplaces, yes, but they're not reaching as many people as they should. And our industrial policies, our social contract, our wage and hour laws all come from the 1930s, from the industrial age, not the digital age. We don't have enough ways to value remote work, virtual work. We don't allow people to keep their benefits, even if they cut back their work a little bit for one quarter of the year and then for another quarter of the year take on more work. We don't have as much flexibility as we should, and it's hurting working families because sometimes everybody in the family who could be working is already working. They don't have enough health insurance, and if there's a catastrophe, they're in real trouble. If a kid gets sick and one of the parents, usually the mother, needs to cut back on work to be with that kid, that isn't compensated by insurance, but it hurts the family income. And my colleague at Harvard Law School shows that a high proportion of bankruptcies, and in fact the rising tide of bankruptcies, is not because of credit card debt, it's because of catastrophe. So there's a lot of things we need to rethink. And also, by the way, one that I care about as somebody who is always an advocate of let's use every bit of talent we can, including women's talent, the lack of flexibility means that a lot of highly educated women, really talented women who have MBAs, law degrees, MDs, PhDs, get to a point where they're having children and they drop out of the workplace, not because that's really what they want to do, they'd like to just cut back their hours, but because they feel the choice is either or. Mm-hmm. And that they won't advance or they won't have a way back in. So that whole cluster of things that have to do with work and family is something that it's time to tackle in the digital age. We really could solve that problem and create more happiness, actually, for families, not just more prosperity.
Yeah, and you also say that companies' businesses should be more honest and transparent and measure and report their social impacts. What does that mean?
Well, definitely they should do that. Well, Europe is already doing that. That is, companies are measured, have been measured in this country almost exclusively on their financial statements, their earnings, cash flow, return on investment, and so forth, return on capital. But we have not had a way of having companies measure themselves, hold up a mirror to themselves, and have the public see. So what are the real costs of the businesses they're in? I was just on a panel with somebody from the World Wildlife Fund who gave an astonishing statistic about the amount of water it takes to produce one cup of Starbucks latte. And it wasn't the amount of water in the latte. It was the water to make the paper. Mm. It was the water that was helping with the distribution. It was an amazing statistic, and I thought, we don't know that. And the more knowledge people have, the more informed decisions they can make. The more transparency, the less likely there will be these kind of stupid corporate scandals, and they really are stupid, where greedy executives are afraid and hide the numbers, and they therefore are taken to court because they've cost the shareholders money. I mean, this is a waste of everybody's time and money. If we had better, more comprehensive reporting systems and more encouragement, more rewards, more prizes for the good guys, the good companies, because there really are good companies out there. And those good companies, like Procter & Gamble, which I know has always been a factor in Wisconsin, those companies, in fact, Procter & Gamble is behind a big initiative to create children's safe drinking water throughout Africa and the developing world. And I'm not sure how many people know that. Well, if people know that, they can applaud it, they can encourage it. So I want that transparency not only to punish and catch the bad practices, but also to reward and mm-hmm. applaud the good practices.
Well, a whole lot to talk about here with Rosabeth Moss Cantor. She's a Harvard business professor and author of America the Principled, Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation. Once again, we've just gone over those six opportunities. What do you think? What questions do you have? Maybe you have other opportunities that you'd like to suggest. To the phones we go. John in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, everything you said makes perfect sense, and I've heard this, what you're saying, in different forms over the last 15 years, but everything you're saying is going to require a responsive legislature. And to go back to drum the common enemy here, we don't have public funding of our campaigns. I was just reading one of the heads of Viacom said he was definitely a progressive Democrat, but he was going to vote Republican because they're citing as one of their main pillars of their party not to have government regulation serve Viacom much better. So he said he was going to vote Republican, and that is the big dilemma. When the head of the Democratic Party, Bill Clinton, says the era of big government's over, you know something's broken here, because as you said, these massive white collar crime frauds we've had over the last 20 years. I'm talking about the SNL crisis, the .com, and now the subprime. They've cost this country collectively as much as two world wars. And God, have they disrupted this country. And it's never going to end. The companies are standing in the path of dealing with global climate change, single-payer health care. They absolutely will not reduce the military-industrial complex, which has led to our imperialism over there in Iraq. So until we hit public funding of both political parties, I don't see how anything that you're going to propose has any chance of occurring.
Well, first of all, you've covered a lot of ground there and very intelligently. I do believe in public financing. I'm on some committee or other which was pushing that. Again, that's very difficult because the people who get elected are getting elected on a different basis. And I think our Congressman Marty Meehan, Senator McCain, I mean, it was all people from all parties have tried to push such legislation through. But before that, I think there are some things that can be done. And it's true that money has a pernicious effect and that running a four-year campaign for an office that people are in 4 years is also quite distracting. I mean, maybe we need another system. But it's partly who we elect on what platform, whether we're doing it locally, we're doing it for Congress, for the Senate, and it's what we demand of them, what questions we ask of them, whether it appears to be good for the voters. You said companies are against all this. Well, I don't know about, I can't speak for Viacom, but I do know that lots and lots of companies are suddenly shifting to the Democrats because it's not just reading the handwriting on the wall, but because they actually see that good government is better for them. You know, in the New Deal, one of the ways FDR got through all those progressive policies was because big business liked the fact they would have a stable environment if they understood what the rules are. And so many big companies simply want to be at the table influencing, that is, having their voice heard in the rules, but they don't mind regulation. And there are, even in the pharmaceutical industry, which has now become an industry that people are sometimes ashamed to be in, it was once ethical drugs and now they feel like tobacco. Even in that industry, there's a difference among companies. Some of them really understand that the public doesn't like high-priced prescription drugs and wants an industry solution for that. So this is a complicated issue. It's partly what we demand of our leaders. You're absolutely right. Bill Clinton, and I quote him in my book, he did say the era of big government is over. It's the era of big citizens, though. He said it was up to us. We needed to start campaigns. We needed to get involved. People don't vote enough in this country at high enough rates. We need social entrepreneurs who develop local solutions like City Year or National Service that then become a national solution. So that's what he meant. And Bill Clinton also believed in government and public service. So reinventing government actually reduced the size of government but made it much more effective. He was not saying, let's eliminate government, let's eliminate taxes. He was saying, let's make it operate more efficiently to higher standards with honorable public servants.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton provided an endorsement of your book as well, saying this book is both optimistic and realistic. It makes two important points. America is still capable of constant renewal and world leadership. To do that, we need innovation, competent, principled leadership in government, business, and civil society, and the book tells us how to do that.
Yeah, I was very happy when he did that. Mm-hmm. Well, Wisconsin also brought us Donna Shalala, who was chancellor at Wisconsin and mm-hmm. Madison, but then served in the cabinet for 8 years in an honorable way, and now as president of the University of Miami, is actually trying to bring the white coat economy to Miami and is still active on national issues. So I consider her a public servant who does public service, whether she's holding office or is doing it as a private citizen.
Yeah. You know, we do hear, though, here in Wisconsin, Professor Cantor, some of unions and others who are concerned about the loss of manufacturing jobs and trade deals that are moving jobs overseas. And are you saying that we should not worry about the loss in those manufacturing jobs and worry more about the white coat economy?
Well, first of all, we should worry when people are being hurt or displaced. We should certainly worry. I mean, that's the kind of country we are, where we want our citizens to have opportunities. So the question of whether we can keep those jobs here, and when I say white coat, I'm talking about drug manufacturing. There's a lot of manufacturing jobs in the white coat economy, medical equipment, for example. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin mm-hmm. has a lot of great medical equipment manufacturers. So there's a lot of manufacturing jobs we could still have. Mm-hmm. It's just that those have to be infused with science. The workers who work on those jobs have to understand math because they're often doing a certain kind of quality control where they don't actually manipulate the machinery. They're reading statistics off computer screens in the factory. So even manufacturing jobs now are heavily white coat. The clean rooms in chip manufacturing plants, for example. So sure, we would love to have those jobs. And I did go to China. One of my chapters on the world talks about going to China in search of those lost manufacturing jobs. And actually, after visiting some of the industrial parks in China, I had to conclude that, sadly, some of those jobs aren't coming back. And it wasn't because of cheap labor. I want to reassure the union people. It wasn't just because they were cheap. It's because they were educating so many process engineers that they could really do a high-quality job. So if we emphasize human talent, educate people for the higher end of manufacturing jobs, have better retraining accounts for the people whose jobs are being lost. And there's a proposal floating around right now, and actually it was a company, IBM, that started this proposal or getting national attention for it, individual learning accounts, that it would be another kind of savings account that the individual would own, that they could use if there was a change, they could use for whatever kind of education or training they personally wanted that would get them that next step in life. So that's, you know, a positive thing we could be doing.
Yeah. Just before we move on to another caller, though, just to kind of wrap up John's call just before, where he said he was not optimistic that this could happen. Do you think Congress, as we know it, is ready to pass the policies needed to implement these changes that you're advocating?
I think, well, he was talking then specifically about campaign finance mm-hmm. reform, and that, I think, is really tough. That's going to only come when we have a president and a Congress sufficiently secure about their jobs, when we have gotten rid of a lot of the ugly partisanship. So I think that one is very, very difficult because, you know, Marty Meehan and Chris Shays tried in Congress and Feingold McCain tried in the Senate. That's very, very hard. Only if there's a huge public outcry and a really, really popular president who has public support for trying some experiments. I don't think we could leap to it all at once. But everything else I'm talking about, I know we can do it because my book is full of concrete, specific examples that show it in place somewhere. You know, the states were once called the laboratories of democracy, and we have laboratories all over the country where somebody is doing it. So the federal government, the Bush administration, shot down stem cell research or restricted it greatly. California passed a statute to invest in stem cell research, and other states have been doing the same. So we have the opportunity to innovate, to create positive change in America. Maybe it's going to have to come from the grassroots, though, not from Congress. But enough pressure from the grassroots, and those people in Congress have to listen to their constituencies or they won't get reelected.
Next, we go to Charles in Ingleside. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I certainly agree that good business and good government are linked together. If the individual person votes, well, they're spending the money, and then the governments are going to pay attention if we vote more. I think this is what the guest is bringing out. My town in Illinois, I live in a township, and we have five villages in the township, and over us is the county that makes duplicates almost everything the towns and the villages do. And I'm impressed with, you know, England government, where the people get together. Well, they hear the administration's cost for maintenance next year and then what innovations they want to make. And then the people vote for those things if they want them. And the people get together. It's just a huge, even the elections, people are getting together. They know each other, and it's like,
You're talking about the town hall meetings in that are common in New England? Is that what you're talking about, Charles?
Right. I want to know if this guest lives at a town, and does she participate with our neighbors that way?
Well, I live in... I'm in Greater Boston. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so we don't have town meetings because we're a little big. We're a city. But I also spend time on a little island off the coast of Massachusetts called Martha's Vineyard, and we have town meetings. We have six towns on that little island, and there are town meetings, and I can look at the details of the budget in my town. Now, unfortunately, that's taxation without representation because I vote... You can only vote one place, so I vote in Cambridge, can't vote there, but I can see the details. I can go to the town meeting. I can ask the selectmen. And it's true, direct democracy makes you feel more involved. What we do in such a vast country, well, we have social entrepreneurs who are starting all kinds of projects that are trying to create that same sense of dialogue and transparency. Getting people involved in public service internships or volunteering in the public sphere, not just in schools but other places, where the knowledge grows, where the accountability grows on those public officials, many get out the vote projects. And in fact, this one of the reasons the Hispanic community is going to have such an effect on this next presidential election is because of all the organizing that's taking place. The internet is an incredible force, and you could force your town to have the equivalent of town meetings on the internet. That is, ask them to post all those details of the budget and continue to insist on it. Go to city council meetings. Get that on the internet. That information spreads. People look at it. We have to use the new tools we have. Because I agree with you, if there's distance between the people and the government, then all kinds of mischief can take place on the part of the government, and also we begin to feel government's the enemy because they don't often treat the public trust with the respect they should.
Our guest is Rosabeth Moss Cantor. She is author of America the Principled, Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. Dr. Cantor is the Arbuckle Professor of Business at Harvard Business School. And we're talking about these different opportunities that she advocates we take up to become America the Principled once again. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. Some of those six opportunities: doing more to encourage technological innovation to solve national challenges, and by getting more people involved in what she calls the white coat economy, by improving family life by shifting away from people sacrificing families and personal lives for work. She says companies could be more honest and transparent and should measure and report their social impacts. And we should favor and support the businesses that do this. She says we should create more respect for government so it can do what we want it to do, what government should do, and that talented people will want to work in government. Just some of the six opportunities for becoming a can-do nation once again. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Time Magazine's Mark Halperin will join Kathleen to discuss politics. It's all things political every Monday after 9 with Kathleen and her guest. After 10, Kathleen will talk with one of the fastest mathematical minds in the world. That's after 10. So hope you stay tuned and join in those conversations. Hope you join in this conversation with Harvard Business Professor Rosabeth Moss Cantor, who is author of the new book, America the Principled, Six Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. She says that Americans are hungry for a progressive agenda that can bring back the American dream. And we're talking about how to do that and welcoming your thoughts and questions for her. Len in Madison is with us now. Hi, Len. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I used to work at one of your competitors, UW-Madison School of Business.
Uh-huh. Well,
but my...
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was
All right, go ahead, Professor Cantor.
No, I was just going to say we think like to think of other business schools as collaborators, not competitors, that's all.
All right,
well,
Len.
Well, that's because you're an elite company, but we are a consortium school just like you are.
Well, go ahead, Len, with what your question or comment was.
Well, I've listened to what the professor said, and I can't say that I agree more. But my question is with everything that's been going on, the professor mentioned the Reagan era and supply-side economics, and I recall being an undergrad at UW-Madison many years ago, and I read a book by Reagan's Commerce Secretary, William Simons. And basically what that book was about how the business and corporate classes were going to take back the power they lost in the Depression by rolling back the social safety net and programs that were ushered in under the New Deal. Well, to cut through all the chase and to make this very straightforward, the professor has mentioned many, many, many things that that could make this country, restore this country, not only restore our government, but restore our democracy. But where does the blame really lie? And what era would you say the American people let it get away from them? And would that blame be on the American people for what we currently have as far as government? Or would we put that blame on the people that are in the government and who are running the government?
Well, look, it's a very good question. It's a very complex world. So it's all of us. And if I'd say when this began, you know, in a sense, we've had a 30-year period of so much prosperity with a few bumps in the road, but so much prosperity and growth that greed began to overtake other kinds of values. And we began to, the 90s in particular, you know, there's such a mixed time because on the one hand, we had a Clinton administration that believed in public service and the economy was highly prosperous, but then we also had that rise of new technology and the dot-com boom in which we were lionizing actually greedy, corrupt business executives like the gang at Enron. They were getting their picture on the cover of magazines because everybody thought, wealth, 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 a new gilded age, it will never end. We're on top of the world. America's the best. World trade is good for us. But it wasn't good for everybody. And you know, countries go through cycles. So that was a cycle of excess. And we came down with a crash in the 2000s because we hadn't dealt with our real enemies, terrorists. We had not solved all the problems. We had excessive investment in technologies that were not going to pay off, and so we came down to sobering reality. And now I think there's a rise of a new mood in which people do want to take back some of the power and control, in which corporations themselves would rather be seen as good guys than bad guys. I mean, you know, those are people too at the top. Nothing a CEO loves better than being at a dinner where he or she is applauded for all the philanthropy and community contributions. So if we all decide, that's why I wrote this book actually, so I appreciate the question, because we need a coherent way of saying, look, there's a way of being where you can have a prosperous economy but still believe in social purpose. Those things are not antagonistic. And I think we could, for all the mess that the world is in, the war in Iraq, the problems in the rest of the Middle East, and so forth, there is still a rising tide I see among young people of idealism. They want to serve. They believe in their country. But we don't have to have an America that thinks it is the only place on Earth and therefore is allowed to consume a disproportionate share of the world's resources. We can have an America that is prosperous but also understands how to support the development of other nations. And that's a question of leadership. So I do think this presidential election is pivotal. We want leaders who stand for restoring those kinds of values. So just ask, do they stand for greed, which is a lot of what this rugged individualism is all about, or do they stand for a sense of community and responsibilities to one another?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Lynn, for the call. Let's go to Mike in Wausau next. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Well, actually, I think that last discussion was a great segue into what I wanted to mm-hmm. say, in that... First of all, I will say that I do work in that white coat economy for the last 20 years between pharmaceutical and now medical device. I fully appreciate and say and agree with what she's saying. That is the kind of thing that Wisconsin and America can excel in and can continue to excel in, so I agree wholeheartedly. But what I do, the concern that I have, and was broached by the last caller, is that I put a lot of the blame of where we're at places like Harvard Business School, places like the Kellogg School of Business, so forth, that for so long have taught at the altar of greed. When they teach Adam Smith, they teach Wealth of Nations, but they don't teach the other treatises of Adam Smith, as he was a philosopher more than an economist. And, you know, he taught about the moral man, and that was the foundation that he built before he wrote The Wealth of Nations. And oftentimes we forget about that, why the business schools don't teach the whole set of Adam Smith and other teachings that show that, yes, we can have a market economy, yes, we can recognize that greed is part of what goes on in an economy, but it's not the only thing. And oftentimes it's not even the most important thing. It is more how does parts of the economy operate. And the problem is I don't hear that. I don't see that being taught. But what we do is we get people coming out that think Adam Smith's invisible hand is a benevolent hand. Well, Adam Smith's invisible hand is benevolent for those that are on the right side of that equation, and it's an iron fist for those that are on the wrong side of that equation. And the sooner we wake up and recognize that as a society, the sooner we will get to where the caller is talking about. Mm.
Boy, I really love that image of invisible hand as an iron fist. Mm. That invisible hand is also sometimes has a lot of oligarchs guiding it. I love the eloquence of public radio, by the way.
Smart
the
listeners,
intelligence. Smart. And listen, I'm trying not to be defensive about whether this is all the fault of Harvard Business School. And one of my best friends and colleagues has just written a book about business schools. But I'm here to talk about my book. But I think business schools, like every educational institution, bear some part of the blame. I went into a business school in part to create change. I started out as a sociology professor. I've been a business consultant. I've been a writer lecturer many, many, many years. I was at Brandeis, at Yale universities. I came to Harvard Business School because business seemed to me, I love Harvard University, but also business seemed to me an institution in need of change, and my work throughout all of these several decades has been about change. I have been the one that has brought ideas of inclusion, fairness, social responsibility to businesses. And I have found the companies that stand for those things, and that's what I teach about, and those are the CEOs I bring to class. And I have to say that whether the students have read Adam Smith or not, we have in our ethics class, they read Adam Smith, they read Milton, they don't read all of Adam Smith, but they read Milton Friedman, but they also read the critics who talk about a different kind of capitalism. And they learn that Europe has a whole different view than the U.S. Asia has a different view than the U.S., that there are other possibilities. And I bring to my classes the chief executives who are incredible role models of what's possible. Business schools, I think, do bear a share of the blame, but they've been providing the product that companies have wanted. And now companies are starting to change, sometimes faster than business schools, because companies are not looking just for MBAs now. They want bright undergraduates who have studied history and therefore understand a little something about the world. We're now in a global world, and you have to understand every other countries too. So I think probably lots of institutions are to blame, but I have another philosophy, and this comes from my last book called Confidence, and that is that anger and blame are unproductive emotions. We should certainly diagnose the situation, but we should look for solutions. And so I prefer to look for the models, the demonstration projects that point the way to the future. And so that's why my book appears to be so optimistic. I mean, if I wanted to, I could run through this horrible critique about nothing will ever change because the forces seem so immutable. But I write about, study about, teach about turnarounds. And I believe turnarounds are possible. And turnarounds often start with small acts. They start with a new consciousness. They start with a new model. And this conversation, I wish I could talk to your listeners forever because these people sound to me like people out of Wisconsin who can be part of a new movement to demand more of our leaders, more and better of our leaders.
Yeah, and we have a time, I think, for an email from John in Chetek, kind of complicated, so I'll try to paraphrase this. My nephew is currently working for a program in Chicago. He is supposed to supervise several people who are teaching inner city kids. However, there are so many hoops that come down from above. He has to jump through them each day. He almost has no time for his job. And he goes on to say that he would like to write a critique of this program when he's finished, but he's afraid if he expresses his honest opinions that are critical of the program and proposed changes of the program, that he's going to get a lousy recommendation for law school from his supervisors. What would you do? Any suggestions for him?
Well, first, I'd get into law school first before I wrote the critique.
There we go.
Yeah, I mean, that's one practical thing. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there's a way to criticize in a positive, constructive way, but you can't do it all by yourself. That's why I was just stressing to your other listeners that we need a movement. This can't be done by individuals. I'm sure if he has seen these things, and it's true, there's often excessive bureaucracy is killing us in public schools like it's killing us in health care, actually. I mean, we should let the professionals, empower the professionals to do their jobs, but you can't make that change all by yourself as a lone individual. It does take a village. You do need to find allies who think the same way you do, get together with them, create a movement, and make it constructive, offer suggestions. But as I said, protect yourself by getting that law school admission first.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. You do have great listeners.
I agree. Thank you again. Rosabeth Moss Cantor is a Harvard business professor and author of America the Principled, 6 Opportunities for Becoming a Can-Do Nation Once Again. America the Principled. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to Christina Taylor for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. If you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444, or listen online. All of our programs are archived on our website, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.